Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Great to be with you. I say that every week, but this week it's especially great to be with you because we have a fun show. Later on, John Thomas is back. This show, like, honestly, only this first segment has anything to do with women. It's only run by women this first time. The end of the show, John Thomas is going to be talking about that phenomenon that irritates us all, but really, what have we done about it? Men in entertainment and beyond who just kind of counteracting the culture's perception of men as just buffoons, basically, and what is our responsibility as Christians to speak against that and really into the situation. So he will be here for that. Culture segment, our own Nathan Pyle, fantastic blogger, did the interview because it is with Michael John on his book Surfing for God and really telling his own story of a longtime addiction with porn and sexual sin of a number of different varieties. So Nathan does a great job with that. And I told him he had a very NPR-ish sounding voice. It was very soothing. So you'll want to, I guess, I don't know, when we do porn interviews, they sound soothing. Maybe that's not good. But he is here for the second segment. And here for our roundtable, as promised, we are going to be doing our women's version of the That's Hot roundtable. We were going to have Paris Hilton here, but she couldn't make it. So we assembled a group of other ladies instead, including our own Suzanne Gosselin.
Hey. Hey, Lisa.
Great to have you here. She's just ready to have a baby. So we're hoping it's not going to happen in the studio because we're not equipped for that. I don't even have my CPR up to date, let me be honest with you. So I'm not going to help you at all. And Martha is here, too, of course.
Yes. Hello, Lisa.
Hey. And new to the table is Anna Coppedge. And I say Anna Coppedge because she used to be Anna Counts, but she just got married. Congrats.
Thanks. Woo-hoo. Thanks.
How's it going for you?
I like marriage. I might keep with it. So.
That's good. We appreciate that. And we support it here at The Boundless Show. So, okay, ladies, we're going to jump right into this because we don't have a lot of time today. And we are the first ones out of the gate. Just for those of you who need to know this, the guys will have their turn at the table as well to talk about what is hot in women. And then we'll just decide if they're accurate, whatever, you know. No, I'm just teasing. This is for you guys to listen in and to decide what you think. I mean, this is like an inside track to a woman's mind. So guys, listen in and don't get all crazy and defensive. Just listen to our opinions because they are just opinions that we have agreed that there are some things that we all agree on and guys just need to pay attention to. So let's just start out. I want to ask you all as we begin, because I think there's kind of this universal understanding that, you know, we all decide that there are some things that are attractive in a guy. So I want you guys to share, when did you first kind of notice that? And when did a pattern emerge for you, or did it, when you finally started realizing, okay, yeah, I really want to have this, I really want to have that, you know, and we're not talking about loves Jesus, okay? Mm-hmm. We're talking keeping the absolute non-negotiables, on the table. Where'd we go from there?
Fourth grade was about when it first came up, and Andy Statler gave me his number 2 pencil during a test. I was like, that's really nice. I like it when boys take care of me. But seriously, no, I think it was kind of in high school I started to gather my thoughts, maybe like with the list per se, and eventually actually drew a picture of what the guy looked like. He had the post-mullet Stephen Curtis Chapman haircut, you know, circa The Great Adventure. Mm-hmm. And wore hiking boots and had good hygiene. So my list has been refined a lot since then.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. I would say in middle school, Saved by the Bell, Zach Morris.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of set the standard for a preppy boy.
Okay.
But in the South, it's very much like hunting and, you know, manly men. And so that kind of shaped. But I think it was after dating a couple of duds in high school and college that you kind of get more refined in what your taste is or what you're drawn to and what you find attractive. Mm-hmm. But after watching Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, Sully. Mm-hmm. So now my hybrid's like a Zach Morris, Sully hybrid there is what I find attractive.
Okay. And we do appreciate, I should tell you, we appreciate you representing the South today.
Oh, Anna. Thank you.
Thank you for that perspective. And representing the North is Martha Frinke.
Yeah, coming from Minnesota. Well, I think I was a late bloomer. I didn't really pay attention to guys a whole lot in high school or college, but when I went to the Focus on the Family Institute, wow, there was all kinds of these godly Christian guys who also loved Adventures in Odyssey.
Oh, my goodness. So,
but also desired to have a family and actually, you know, had career and ministry pursuits in mind for their lives. So that was pretty exciting.
And all in the same room. I mean, that's kind of like a concentration.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. That's good. Yeah, and I don't know where it came about for me either. I think I was a little bit also kind of clueless, maybe didn't pay attention. But I had, you know, little pseudo-boyfriends in grade school and beyond and stuff. And then, yeah, didn't do a lot of dating. But I think I always recognized the guys who, you know, I always saw the guys that I thought, wow, they're really cool. And then I had to step back and be like, why do I think they're really cool? Mm-hmm. And so then some of those patterns emerged. So let's talk. I'm going to go ahead and kick it off by saying one of the things that I think is totally hot in a guy, and I don't know that I've ever super referenced this on the show, but I'm going to say it because honestly, this pertains, it involves a little smackdown to some of you guys that are out there. Okay, so I'm going to take the heat for this one. I think it's totally hot when a guy has confidence, okay? Mm-hmm. And by confidence, I mean knows what he is about. He doesn't have to be, you know, super awesome, super high earner, super whatever. But guys, those of you that comment on the blog and or email us, and I'm like, praise God, Martha's the filter for this, because sometimes I'm just like, I don't even want to see it. I don't even want to hear, read your emails or whatever. Mm-hmm. But whining, just, you know, the guys that are like, I can't do anything because the women have just taken over, or I can't do, you know, women are so rude to me, and women are blah, 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 and women earn more than I do, and blah, 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 blah. So a guy who has confidence, who just knows what he is about and doesn't have to be great at everything and doesn't have to be trying to outperform other people or whatever, just a quiet confidence is awesome. Mm-hmm. Just putting it on the table.
Agreed.
Yeah, I would agree too. And coming from like a Christian perspective, kind of that identity in Christ, like someone who's kind of seeking to embrace manhood in the way that God has spelled it out in Scripture, you can really see when someone is doing that as opposed to someone who's defining themselves by maybe more worldly standards.
Yeah, which guys totally call us out on too. You know, they're like, I don't want these needy, clingy girls that just are looking to me for all their, you know. So I'm like, let's be honest here. Let's be equitable.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. What are some other ones that you, when I threw this question out to you, what were the big kingpin ones for you guys?
To piggyback on what you said about confidence, I say like humility in the confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, still being a confident guy and a leader definitely is attractive. I think I lose respect for guys that just kind of let the wife make the decision and wear the pants in the family. Mm-hmm. And you see that and you're like, why is he like that? So taking leadership, but being humble about it, and like I think also on that servant leadership, and servant-hearted leadership. So a guy that will bust his tail right alongside you, working hard, but still at the end of the day he's making the decisions. He's, you know, you discuss it and you talk about it, but you know he's working hard and he's leading the family.
That's good.
I think another way to say confident is just responsible. That's something that I really admire of someone who's disciplined and self-controlled and is going somewhere in life is attractive.
Share your example about the car for that, because it's good.
Well, this is kind of, I don't know, something I pay attention to on a first date is what car the guy drives. And to me, I would prefer that it be a used car. If it's too, I mean, if it's brand new or just too flashy, I'm probably going to kind of question his financial wisdom. So,
but that's the funny my thing. Yeah, the funny thing was, is Martha and I were talking about that earlier, and I said, well, when my husband started courting me, he just bought a new car, and it didn't even occur to me that, oh, that might be an irresponsible thing that he did. It was more like, I enjoy going on dates in a nice, clean car. It just didn't even occur to me. So for me, that wasn't a deal breaker. And it does turn out that Kevin is responsible with his money. There's kind of a whole backstory to why he had a new car at that season of life. But
yeah. Well, and it wasn't like he was trying to peel around the corner in a Ferrari.
No,
either.
No.
I mean, they're, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, a new car, you bought it, you invested in it, whatever. If you have the money to pay for it, that's fine. Yeah.
But
I mean, I personally, no. Where I am right now, I don't want some guy picking me up in something all rusted out. I'm like, you know what? You know, okay, maybe someone who's like really young or whatever, but don't go picking me up in some rusted out.
Well, I think it can be for more than like, it's like a lot. We live so much out of our means now, and there's so much debt, credit card debt, or whatever. It's like, you do question that and you're like, all right, are you, I mean, I think there's a balance of it, but I think our culture, we're so like spending as much money as we can that we don't have.
Well, which is a really good point, because women, especially women who have been single for a while, I think many of us are so exhausted of working with Excel spreadsheets and figuring out our budgets and doing all these bills and whatever, you know. It's like a guy that comes along and he loves dealing with money and loves being responsible and loves taking care of things. I think that's hot.
Yeah.
You know, responsibility, like Martha said. Okay, now Suzanne, you put kindness on the list. So talk to us about kindness.
I think something that I started noticing even in high school and college was I would watch how a guy treated everyone else, because it's easy for a guy to be super nice and pour on the charm if he's interested in you. But I would watch and see, is he consistently kind to the people around him? Because that's the kind of person that I want to be with ultimately. And so that was something that I find super attractive, is when he doesn't even know you're looking and he is showing kindness or generosity to someone else. That's super hot.
Yeah.
Especially to, I think, kids or the elderly or disabled or people that, I mean, really, he's not going to get anything back from. That really stands out.
This is what I call the Mr. Knightley trait. And I hate throwing things on Pride and Prejudice characters, because guys are just like, snoozerama. But seriously, guys, if you want a quick little primer on this, watch Emma. Watch the movie Emma. And watch what Mr. Knightley does when Harriet is at the ball and doesn't have anyone to dance with. And Mr. Knightley hates dancing. But he knows what's right to do, and he does it without anyone asking him. And so, you know, for a girl that wouldn't be the first pick, for the girl that wasn't the prettiest in the room, and he was well, you know, head and shoulders above everyone else in stature and influence and wealth and stuff like that. So just saying, Mr. Knightley had some important things to teach you.
Yeah, especially like how, if he's kind when the, you know, gets messy, when it gets hard and the struggles, if he's like avoiding playing Xbox and retreating and not wanting to deal with it, so unattractive. But if he's wading through the muck and the mud of your life, or whatever his life is, that I think is a true test, because it's easy to be nice when people are watching, or when you, even if you don't get something out of it, but it's like in public. But what happens when there's hard stuff going on, you know?
Okay, who else has one to throw out?
How about a shallow one?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Well, another one I thought of is just facial hair. Some guys do it well and some guys don't. But I think if you're looking, I mean, if you're in the looking stage, I would say err on the side of shaving and then maybe grow a beard or whatever later.
Oh, okay.
But
that's interesting.
I mean, it's hygiene to me, I guess. I don't know. Suzanne's going to disagree with this one too. But.
Well, no, I was going to say that personal hygiene is still like a really big one for me. And it's so simple for guys to do. It's like just take a shower a couple a day, wear deodorant, you know, just so that you don't have some weird smell that's just, you know, turning people off. But
wear clean clothing.
Yeah. And actually on my original list, I said no facial hair. That was something I kind of held to as my type through college. But I think by the time I met my husband, I was 30 years old, and his facial hair, he does it well. It's very trimmed and everything. Oh. So it looked good on him. And I'm like, well, he is 8 years younger, so the facial hair helps even out the age difference look. And so I was fine with it.
Cool. Yeah. You are, Anna, you are very recently married.
Yes.
How long now?
Almost 3 months.
Wow. Yes. Okay. So yeah, pretty newbie.
Yes.
What would you say, because now you've got your husband, what for you, looking back, are the biggest things where you said that's hot?
Yeah, we have an interesting story, because we knew each other in college. So we were friends for about 4 years before we started dating. And there was a lot of, you know, we lived really close in town to each other, and then we lived like an hour away from each other. And then it wasn't until I moved to Colorado that he's like, hey, let's date. So that was a little hard at first going into our dating relationship, because it's like, all right, what was the reason why you're holding back? Is it lack of leadership or whatever? And I know now what those issues were, or what he was thinking through. He thinks through a lot of things, and he's very purposeful. So, and he also thought he was called to be single for a long time. So he was 30, you know, before we started dating. So the qualities that I always saw, I mean, he was, when we became friends, I liked him like right away. And I think I always held him to the standard, other guys to the Ben standard. And so the qualities that I've found attractive in him from the get-go is he's very fix-it. Like he builds bookshelves and coffee tables and like beautiful things, and he takes care of our cars, and Very capable kind of guy. So I've always appreciated that about him. And Suzanne brought up a good point that that's how my dad is too. And so I guess I just always noticed that quality about him and was drawn to that. But that, and then I would say he's very much a servant-hearted leader. And then he wears a John Deere hat, which is just hot. I mean, he started wearing that in college, and I was like, I want to marry that man.
Is it like the spongy, like foam kind of John Deere?
No, it's like the, it's almost like a baseball cap. It's not, but it's the dark, you know, the hunter green with the John Deere. I love that hat. So great.
Wow.
I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a southern thing where you're like, cheers. And I don't know what it is, but I love it. So.
Wow. Okay.
I really do think that what women consider hot, I mean, it varies very much from woman to woman, and a lot of what plays into it is sort of your comfort level, like what you grew up with and what touched you as a child or a young woman as you were growing up. And for me, yeah, my dad couldn't fix things, so that never was part of my experience, but he was a really good family man. He would get off work early to go to our events and our plays and sports and things like that, and he was in a couple of musicals with me, and you know, just things that those, that time investment was what really touched me. So for me, it's like my husband isn't a super fix-it guy, but he'll take care of things when they go awry. But that's not a big deal to me.
I think it's interesting, too, how we, probably many guys look at us and see how we are, and then they think that that's what we're going to be looking for. Like, I think a lot of guys look at me and they're like, oh, you know, anyone who dates Lisa is going to have to be super extroverted and really confident, really crazy and whatever. And I'm like, no, do we really need this times two? I don't think so. You know, so it's funny because for me, someone who's like quiet, like I said, that quiet confidence who just knows their business and is like, doesn't have to struggle for the quote unquote spotlight as much as it is or whatever, you know, me in a ministry. And, and stuff like that. It is just great. You know, someone who just is like, here are my giftings and they are certainly not yours. And, you know, and I would be like, they certainly are not. Which kind of brings me to, again, a guy, this is another one of mine, someone who has care, even as a brother in Christ. So I'm not even someone who's interested in me, but someone who has care for my safety, both physical and emotional. So the guy who, like, say we're coming back from a thing and it's nighttime and he, some guy who just steps up and says, you're not going to walk to your car alone. I'm going to walk with you. And when I say that, I mean, you have to say you are not going to walk to your car, not, hey, well, I don't know if maybe you want me to walk to your car. You know, that just the wishy-washiness, just stop it. OK, just say, you know, I'm walking with you or I'm going to help you. I'm going to carry this bag for you. I'm going to do that. Just step up and say you're going to do it and stop giving women all these options about to refuse you and stuff.
Hey, do you want my chair? Because I'll get out of the couch if you want to sit here. But if you're okay on the floor, you like,
it like pushes it back on us.
Yeah,
like, right. Like, you make the decision. I'm not going to make it. Like, I don't want to be the bad guy here.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Well, but, Lisa, you know, if you do take the chair, then, you know, you're just lazy. And
Well, Lisa, don't you think you can kind of tell if a guy is putting that on, like it doesn't come naturally to him, but he's like, now that I'm interested, I better open the door. Like, you can kind of tell that difference, too. It's better if it's just a habit in his life.
Right.
And like right now, Kevin, he's still, after church on Saturday night, he'll walk out all the ladies that are working in the building just to make sure they get to their cars okay. So again, it goes back to that, how is he treating all women?
Yeah. And that's hot. And I say the emotional thing too, because guys who are willing to step in a hard situation where, you know, I've had to step up before in a situation, whether it's a conflict or something, and I've had to defend myself, or I've had to, and I feel like I'm on the witness stand or I'm something, and I've heard it. I mean, I've heard it spoken to me before. Well, Lisa, you can handle it because you're strong or you're opinionated or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I don't want to be. Maybe I want a guy to come in and say, I'm going to help you with this, or I'm going to defend you, or I'm going to. So I'm just saying from the heart.
Anyway, that's good.
That's just one of mine. So what else?
I would say another thing is work ethic. If he's a hard worker, if he's been, you know, not a workaholic, obviously, but if he worked in high school and if he's working in college, it's not just he's living off his parents at 24, you know. And then praying is a big thing. If he's initiating prayer, if he's initiating spiritual growth and challenging, it doesn't have to look like every morning we're going to read a psalm and talk about it. I think it needs to be a natural thing. But a guy I dated in college, it was such a, we call him vanilla ice cream. Like, he was just so bland. And like, I mean, obviously there's reasons why you date because you attracted to him and stuff. But that was one of the things. We never prayed together. We never talked about spiritual things. It was totally a lot of superficial stuff. And so I think a man who's taking his role as a spiritual leader seriously in a marriage is attractive, or in a dating relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And along with that, I think a guy who has some goals and ambition mm-hmm. for his life and mm-hmm. isn't just looking for a girlfriend, but actually has ideas and plans for his future. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty attractive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I would say with this is a good distinguisher between age. Like for me, like where I am, I need a guy with a good job. I'm not really into the trajectory anymore because I'm like, I personally don't think I can marry someone that's 19 anymore. I'm a little older than that, you know, being 22. So,
right.
But anyway, you know, so for me, that's just something that's personally important to me. But collectively at Boundless, we talk about trajectory and how that's important. So guys who are young and in your 20s, get that going now so you can move in that direction, you know, in that way.
Yeah. I really see responsibility as being equal to being trustworthy mm-hmm. of, are you on time for things? You know, how do you handle your money? Mm-hmm. How do you handle your time? Just all of that really, I think, speaks well of a man, of mm-hmm. how responsible and trustworthy he is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other, just quickly to run through, anything else that you guys just want to put on the list?
Letters. I think that's such a lost art. I mean, we're so quick on text, email, whatever. Mm-hmm. But letters that's thoughtful and, like, articulate and very encouraging. I mean, I have all Ben's letters from before we even started dating. Mm. Just because I love that. Just, like, even, you know, a little card once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Ability to put a sentence together really is attractive. Yeah.
Yeah, that is good. I would say I would put on the list, and this is just kind of a weird one, he has married friends, like guys that are still running in kind of the frat boy circles and stuff. I think a guy who has cultivated and kept married friendships where it's not just around their common, maybe their friends have gotten married or whatever and they've been able to maintain that relationship, but just to have people in other life stages in your life who are, you know, being real and stuff, that's big for me.
Mm-hmm. Someone who dresses nicely.
Mm-hmm.
It's that could be a little superficial, but if you're thinking of, well, what is something I could do today
mm-hmm.
that would increase my attractiveness? I think just, you know, going to someone you trust who you think has good fashion sense and saying, hey, what do you think about the kinds of clothes I wear?
Mm-hmm. Which makes me wonder, you know, it's so funny because you see guys who are just a little sketchy on that front and then they get married and then all of a sudden they look really good and you
right.
know that their wives have helped them. I'm like, why don't you do that on the front end, go to some woman in your church who, like, can help you out, get started earlier. Yeah, totally. I would say, too, for me, like, guys knowing how to cook or knowing how to do whatever isn't so huge for me. But I think, like, especially in the church context, guys need to have, like, three things on their game that they can bring to something. Because, the guys, if you're 35 and you're still bringing a bag of chips to a potluck, I mean, it's just kind of like, can you just get it together? And then I also really like guys who can grill. That's just a little superficial thing for me. Guys who know how to grill and know how to put a good rub on a steak and know what works with what. Just saying.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I would add is sexual purity really is attractive. I know it's something that a lot of guys struggle with, and I think most girls kind of plan for the worst in that area. But, you know, if you have messed up in the past, to make a renewed commitment and get accountability in your life, that really will speak volumes to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not so much that you've never made mistakes, but that we can see that you're being very intentional about how you're going about being pure now and that you have some things in place. That's very attractive.
Mm-hmm. That's good. All right. So as we close out here, let's just talk about, because a lot of these guys are like overwhelmed and hopefully they've been jotting down some notes and hopefully they're identifying that woman or guy in the church that they need to have a little one-on-one with and be like, help me out here, which is great, guys. That also is very hot, getting help. But I just want us to encourage the guys with, what pluses do these guys already have? What do they have in their corner just by being guys? So their baseline, what do they have going for them?
I don't know if anyone's read the book about guys have the waffle brain and girls are like spaghetti. But really, the waffle brain is a great strength that you just have naturally. The fact that you can kind of compartmentalize areas. And instead, I think that's how women can sometimes panic and just get crazy, as Lisa would say, of everything touches everything else. And it makes us worry sometimes. But your steadiness really is helpful.
And I think guys they misunderstand that. They think that we are really and women have helped to perpetuate this, I think, by thinking, oh, we need these super emotional guys that want to just chit chat with us for 4 hours into the night and talk about all our emotions and stuff. And again, it comes down to, we don't need another one of us, you know, but you need to own who you are and step out with that and don't try to play both sides, I think.
I think also just kind of basic caring and protective nature that God has instilled in men. Mm-hmm. When I think back to being single all through my 20s, there was never one single time or one single guy where if I asked him to help me with something, he didn't just jump at the chance to help me. And so just the fact that guys seem to be wired that way. And I would encourage guys to just embrace that. If you're feeling a little nervous, like, I don't know, does she need my help or not need my help? I mean, offer to help her move, offer to help her with mowing her lawn or whatever, because I think that really stands out.
I have a good example of that. My furnace filter is underneath my house. It's in a crawl space. And when I go down, I basically am like, I'm either going to get bit by a black widow or I'm going to get stuck under there and just shrivel away to a skeleton or whatever. It's just a scary, I have to crawl on dirt under there. And one of my guy friends was just like, Lisa, let me put it on my calendar now. When can I come over and do that for you? And I'll just put it on a regular rotation of being willing to do that. And I was just, that is so cool. An extreme example of that is what we saw happen up in Denver with the Aurora shootings, you know, with the men who instinctively protected their girlfriends, their wives, the women next to them. I don't even know who those guys were, and I've never seen photos of them or anything, but I think that what they did was hot. All right, ladies, these are some great thoughts. I mean, I think we threw a lot of things on the table and gave you guys some great opportunity to speak back to us on this. What do you think? Is there anything that you feel you have as far as equality and it's still backfired against you, you know? But don't do it in a whining voice. Just tell us honestly, okay? Because remember, no martyrs, no whiners. But anyway, I just think guys do have a lot going for them. I think our culture is just completely like fighting against you guys. I just heard on the way to work this morning that Demi Lovato song, Give Your Heart a Break. And I'm like, seriously? This girl is stepping in and just being like, oh, yes, the poor little thing. Let me just help you and let me be the strong one and just help you through your terrible breakup and whatever. And I'm like, ladies, can we stop singing these stupid songs, basically, and let men be men? And just, you know, it doesn't help in our respect of them at all. And guys, you know, obviously you want that and we owe that to you. So great thoughts, ladies. Of course, we will hear from all of you on the blog, so please do jump into the fray. And thanks to Suzanne, Anna, and Martha for being very honest in your responses about what is hot.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks. I got the rhythm, she's got the moves, all tight fits in all the right grooves. She'll get the rug if I cut her loose. Sugar rush ends in a crash. Every week's got a flavor, but it never lasts. Bad taste, I'm guilty of that, I know. Well, I've never been a class A act. I'm an overachiever with my courtesy laughs, but I could fake a mean heart attack when I'm losing control.
Hey everybody, my name is Nathan Pyle, filling in for the always excellent Lisa Anderson as today's host of the Culture segment. I'm an occasional roundtable panelist slash guest and former Boundless blogger too. You may have read some of my articles. I'm not pitching that you should read those articles. I'm just saying you may have. anyway, I am hosting today for the Culture segment, and today we're going to be talking about the issue of pornography, specifically pornography addiction, which is not solely a male issue, but certainly a prominent one among men. The brain is wired for this God-given desire for intimacy. Men in particular can harness that wiring to demand something completely at odds with God's design for intimacy in the form of pornography. We're going to be discussing all of that with our guest today, Michael John Cusick, author of Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle. Welcome, Michael, to the Boundless Podcast.
Thank you, Nathan, for having me on the program.
Yeah, it's an interesting subtitle of your book, Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle, because it implies that this isn't just a physical need, right, that men have whenever they get involved and ensnared in pornography.
That's right. Yeah, typically we think this is an issue of the eyes and that it's just about sex and beautiful bodies and images, but it's really something spiritual. As a matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians 6:16, Paul said, and I'm translating from or using the paraphrase of the Message, he said that sex is more than just skin on skin, but it's as much spiritual mystery as physical fact. And so I think a lot of what is driving this compulsion is a kind of spiritual emptiness and disconnection from our own heart and the heart of God.
Mm-hmm. And your story of pornography addiction is a long one, beginning, unfortunately, as a child when you were sexually abused and progressed through adulthood and eventually right into your marriage. Could you walk us, walk listeners through kind of your story and your progression up to that point?
Yeah, the short version of it is that I was sexually abused at the age of 4 and actually used in pornography by an uncle who was a sadistic child abuser, and grew up in my family continuing to be abused and use pornography and be exposed to it. Became a Christian at age 16. That was a pretty dramatic turnaround and discovered the love of God. But what I really got into was a model of now I can work really hard to overcome the shame that I feel inside, rather than realizing that my relationship with Jesus was something that meant that I could rest in his love. And what I was motivated by was a sense of I've got to be good enough to actually please God, and not realizing that he was profoundly and forever pleased with me apart from my behavior. And so I developed a double life as a Christian, and I became on the outside the quintessential outgoing, charming leader. I developed a youth ministry and developed that double life all the way, as you said, into my marriage. And 3 years into my marriage, the worst day of my life and the best day of my life, I was caught in my double life, and all of that was exposed. And for a number of hours, I sat down and just poured out my story of deception and pornography, and at that point it escalated to use of prostitutes and massage parlors and all other forms of sex for pay. And that was the day, however, 14 years after receiving Christ, that I actually came to encounter the love of God. And that's the thing that began to set me free, because that really struck a blow to the shame that I was walking around with inside, this belief that there's really something fundamentally flawed, deficient, and wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. I want to discuss that day that you dubbed D-Day, which was July 10th, 1994. This is where it did all kind of come out, where you described your best and your worst day. What happened there? How did that play out?
I came home from work earlier than I said I would be. I had actually called my wife and said I would be working for several hours, and then I showed up at the door 20 minutes later, and I had become so self-deceived and so caught up in my own lies and one lie to cover another lie and another lie that I'd actually forgot what I told her. And she said, you know, what are you doing home? And I started to kind of get tongue-tied and the blood drained out of my face. And she said, what's going on? And I knew at that moment it was as if God was saying to me, this is a fork in the road, that you can continue to hide and pretend and wiggle your way out of this, or you can be free. And so I chose the latter, which was really a form of humiliation and exposure and being caught. And the fear, of course, all the years that I was married and throughout my life, was that if anybody ever knew what I was really like and what I really thought and what I did in the shadows, that I could never be loved, that I would lose everything that was valuable to me. And that didn't happen on that day. And my wife, we were separated for a short period of time, and we slept in two different rooms for a long, long time. But just recently, we celebrated 21 years of marriage, and it's not been easy, but it's been glorious and beautiful, and more than anything, I think it's been transformational for each one of us, that this struggle has become something that was a window into God saying, I really want to have your heart at a much, much deeper level. And the beautiful thing that I learned then and continue to learn and speak about, Nathan, is that the very things that we think are barriers to knowing God and being more intimate with him, that when we bring them into the light and simply say, here it is, I'm not going to hide this or hold it anymore, that God takes that very struggle, like a struggle with porn or masturbation or lust or sex addiction, and he actually uses it as a bridge to becoming more intimate with him instead of a barrier. And that's a profound idea that we don't often connect with our Christian faith.
Yeah, that's very well said. I think also the intimacy and the closeness you develop with your wife after that point, when the closet is open and everything is pulled out and you're there in front of her completely exposed, that had to be a new level of intimacy with her that you can rebuild trust from.
Yeah, I never had any idea what was available in real relationship where you're not hiding and pretending to be somebody you're not. And for the people that are listening thinking, well, you know, porn, using it makes me feel guilty, or it makes me feel maybe like I'm not less of a, or I'm less of a Christian, but, you know, it really isn't affecting anybody. And I would say that that's a lie from the pit of hell, that it affects our capacity not only to be intimate with God, but with others, because there's a big part of ourselves that we have to hide to go through life, especially for those who are involved in some form of ministry or serving God, even part-time, that, you know, you have to put on your game face. And then there's the other you, and that other you can't really be loved until it's brought out and known.
That's such a good point. As you say, this is not an isolated sin, far from victimless. On that note, prior to Julianne finding out about your addiction, how did this affect your marriage long before any of this came out?
I think mostly I was dead. I was just emotionally disconnected from myself. I was pretty superficial. I told her that I loved her and that I wanted to be this loving Christian husband, but honestly, and this sounds harsh, internally I hated her. And I hated her because she was a real woman with real needs, and she wasn't just a doormat that would say whatever I wanted or did. And so she required me, in the very best sense of the word, to be a man. She required me to engage and to step up. And because of my abuse, because of the lies that I believed about who I was, that I was just this deficient, flawed person, there was no way that I could step up with my heart and be real. And so the 3 years that went into the marriage, I became increasingly dead and distant and disconnected. And I think that it was God's mercy to really wake me up, because, you know, it was so much more than moving away from pornography and an addiction that's gone, but it was moving into a kind of life that God created, in terms of intimacy and joy that I really never believed existed, that was for other folks, not for me.
Hmm. You touch on something that I really want to hit on, and that is you mentioned Julianne being a real-life woman who has demands, requirements of you as a man. And in your book, you mentioned how pursuit, men are really good at pursuing things, whether that be the career move that's next or a better time in a marathon run. But when it comes to pursuing a woman, we should feel strong doing that, but you say a lot of men don't feel that adequacy, that confidence in the presence of a real woman, and that's where pornography can come in and kind of fill that void falsely, requiring nothing of them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so often when I talk with men and or women about this issue of lust or porn, people think that the conversation is going to be about sex, and so often it's not, at least not in the way we typically think of sex. Sexuality has more to do with the core of our masculinity and femininity and what that means and how God designed us to relate out of that. And so it's not uncommon for me to ask a man in one of our first conversations, where in your life do you feel the strongest as a man? And just like you said, they'll go through a whole list of things, but never in my whole ministry career of close to 30 years have I heard a man initially say, oh, I feel strongest as a man in relation to my wife, girlfriend, or fiance. And that's because when we start to move into that level of actual intimacy and being who we are in the presence of them being who they are, who God really made us to be, we feel pretty weak, we feel pretty inadequate, and like we just don't have what it takes. And so we put on a game face, we become an imposter or a poser, and act as if we really do have what it takes. Mm. And so porn kind of whispers to a man that you can feel like a man, but it is not going to actually require you to be one. And the effect of that, quoting C.S. Lewis, is that pattern chips away at our manhood. And so we actually become less able to be strong and to engage over time. And there's a kind of erosion of the soul. And the equivalent of this for women, because 40%, depending on the survey, up to 40% of women are struggling with online porn. Mm-hmm. The equivalent would be that porn allows a woman to feel vulnerable and delighted in without actually having to be vulnerable. And so there's kind of a parallel in terms of the feminine promise that porn makes to them. Hmm.
There's a story in the book of a man who looks to, quote-unquote, get back at his wife. I think that's worth touching on because our emotions as men, especially when we get upset, we can easily go into this selfish realm, just part of the human condition. Why would there be this vengeance attitude behind pornography when a man maybe feels disrespected by his wife? Why would he go down that path?
Well, it's interesting. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus takes two issues and he reorients them to being about the actual behavior to something in the heart. And one is lust, so you just have to look at a person lustfully to commit adultery, and the other is murder. You just have to call someone a name or have anger in your heart, and that's murder. And it's interesting that porn and sex addiction can actually combine the two of those together. And so, in fact, as you're telling about the story in the book, it was a man who we were talking, and he had done everything possible to overcome his addiction. He had been to 3 workshops. He had read other books. And he kind of came to one of my intensive programs as a last-ditch attempt. And early on, I said to him, this may kind of offend you, but do you ever think about your porn use as a way to get back or stick it to your wife? And I was kind of expecting him to be defensive and say, yeah, that's just a bunch of psychobabble. And he actually smiled, and he said, well, of course. And no one had ever put that category out there for him before. And he said, it's just like when somebody cuts me off in traffic, they're long gone, but I'm kind of giving them the middle finger, and it makes me feel better. It makes me feel powerful. And so in his case, his wife would reject him for sexual intimacy, largely because it was just the physical act, and she felt used and exploited. There was no emotional connection. Mm-hmm. And so she was setting a boundary, and every time she did that, he would go look at porn thinking, well, I'm getting back at you. And if we're honest, I think that sometimes that is a far, far, far more common thing than we want to admit as guys. It might be toward a girlfriend. It might be at a boss. But the bottom line is that we feel that sense of power and strength and masculinity, and then as soon as it's over, of course, we feel a sense of emptiness and less like a man. But that revenge aspect is very, very real.
Yeah, one thing that resonates with me when you say that is the man may go to his wife and engage in sex, and it be there no intimacy there. And I think, again, that goes back to he doesn't really know how to display that intimacy because he's not living that fully intimate life with his wife when he has pornography in the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a recent book where I was on the 700 Club recently talking about the demise of guys, and this secular book by Philip Zambrano, who says that video games and porn are making it so that young men today, contrary to even 20 years ago, 10 years ago, they have almost zero capacity for intimacy because of how porn shapes them and how the arousal of the soul, not necessarily sexual arousal, but just that sense of aliveness, what we call autonomic nervous system arousal, that can only happen in non-relational ways. And so sitting down in front of a real woman, there's literally no capacity for that. It's like speaking a foreign language. And therefore, the relationship becomes sexualized, and a whole vicious cycle gets in place where a woman may feel used or victimized, and the man may feel like the only thing that's valuable there is the sexual relationship. Mm. And, of course, that's not only wrong but and unhealthy, but it's far, far, far from the joy and the gift that God created us to experience.
Yeah. Michael, I want to get into some of the practical, the accountability side of all this, maybe for a man listening who's struggling with this or knows someone who is. Specifically in the book, you say we have an inaccurate definition of accountability, and you say there's actually 3 types of accountability we need. Can you explain those and how those work?
Yeah, very quickly. The most common kind of accountability is what I call a cop. And that is where if I'm your accountability partner, you come to me and say, hey, I'm struggling with sin or struggle X, Y, or Z, and I want you to write me tickets and bust me when I sin. And this arrangement presumes that because I have to tell you about my sin that I'm not going to do it. And it's a very shame-based kind of model. And most men I know, frankly, who have struggled with for any amount of time with lust, they're like, oh, accountability, okay, whatever. Because they know that it doesn't work. Now, in some cases, we do need someone in our face saying, dude, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. But that can't be the end. And then the next kind of accountability goes from cop to coach. And that's where the person in our life becomes someone who The relationship is defined by they encourage you and they inspire you and they motivate you to be more godly. The emphasis is less on not sinning and it's more on doing right, but it's still externally motivated. And without that person in our life, we may kind of go back to our normal pattern. Sometimes that's necessary as well. We all need encouragement and exhortation. The third kind, and I think it's the ideal, is what I call cardiologist accountability. And that's when a person who they don't need to be a therapist or counselor or anything like that, just is curious about what's going on in the person's life and at a deeper level and what the person's hungers and thirsts are and what they long for. And I address some of that in the book about how to have conversations with one another about our desires and longings. But the whole idea of cardiologist is really based on the fact that as believers, we have a new heart. We are new creations, and therefore our heart is good. And that the idea of the heart being desperately wicked from Jeremiah 17, that's not only Old Testament, but it's Old Covenant. And so now our heart is good, and the heart of a believer, their deepest desire is to love God and walk in His ways, which means at any given time, if we are sitting down talking about a struggle with lust or porn or stealing or cheating or gambling, there's always a deeper desire that we have to unearth and help someone understand what stands in the way of that. Mm-hmm. So the cardiologist accountability is really based on our true identity, that we are saints and not sinners. And the reason why we're sinning is that there's some kind of a payoff or promise that it gives us based on a need that's not being met in God.
Mm-hmm. Along the lines of accountability, Michael, I'm thinking of the Christian man, new husband, loves his wife, has a healthy relationship with her, and he cringes at the term addiction because, well, I've slipped a few times in the past looking at porn. I'm past that now. No need to expose anything. I've repented privately. I don't really need to go any further than that. What would you say to that man struggling there?
Well, I would say we don't need to wrestle over the word addiction because people have different words for different things, but Paul's really clear in Corinthians. He says, if it masters you, then it's really not good for you. It's not beneficial for you. And so that person might slip once or twice, but I would say to them that there's a monster lurking underneath the surface, that rather than see it as a sin to suppress, that there's an opportunity to explore whatever is taking them there that is an opportunity for growth, not only between them and God, but between them and their wife. There may be a deep unmet need in terms of the intimacy emotionally. There may be an issue going on that's a wound from the past. And I would say to that person to talk to another man and be brutally honest about where you're at, to reach out in some way, and to realize that the struggle is not just about having a bad day or making a mistake, but that your heart is actually searching for something and wanting something that you're currently not experiencing.
Right. It's not something that you can just say, I'm moving past this. It's not a white knuckle through it kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Trying harder doesn't get us anywhere in our battle with sin.
Mm. Along the lines, too, of accountability, another practical would be rebooting, kind of rewiring your mindset. What's the starting point for that, and what does that look like day to day?
Well, realizing, too, that this is much more than just a person's will, but that after a person looks at online porn over a time, the intense novelty and freshness and availability of images creates an overstimulation of dopamine in the brain, which is the gimme, 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 I want it chemical. And with that overstimulation of dopamine, it actually creates, on the other side of the two neurons that are speaking to one another all throughout the brain, a diminished capacity to feel satisfaction. So the brain becomes addicted to its own brain chemistry, if you will, and there's a vicious cycle of always hungry and never satisfied. And so if you're eating but never satisfied, you'll just keep eating and eating and eating. And the rebooting is actually part of how you can rewire the brain. And that's a process of saying, for 90 days, I'm going to be accountable to someone. If that's a married man, it's probably best not to do that with your wife, although you may tell her that you're going through this process. And to not just white-knuckle it and say, okay, this time I'm going to try really hard, but to be totally reoriented that this is not an issue of the will per se, although that will be involved, but it's an issue of allowing your brain to shut off and to reboot just like a computer. And over 90 days, that's probably the minimal amount of time that is required for the brain to rewire itself. And I've seen that happen again and again, that when men are armed with this knowledge that it's the brain that is craving and not their true heart, which is a new heart, that gives them a new hope and a new target at which they're aiming. So the rebooting process is 90 days, and then the rewiring process goes on and on forward forever. And that's really living out Philippians 4:8 that talks about, you know, whatever is lovely, whatever is beautiful, whatever is excellent, admirable, praiseworthy, think about those things. Neuroscience now proves to us, Nathan, that what we think about actually wires our brain in a certain way. And so the more we think about or give ourselves to porn, and those images are in our mind forever, presumably, that our brain actually gets wired for porn in that kind of way. So it becomes the path of least resistance.
Hmm. Michael John Cusick, I appreciate your insight and sharing your heart with our audience here today. A lot of great practical tips as well as an explanation for what's really going on when someone looks at pornography, especially in today's culture. It's such a prevalent topic. Thank you for being on here with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Caroline, yeah, was my kind of girl. Then she up and fell in love with herself. Think she's gotta be some celebrity. I just gotta know, is she leaving me? I called her on her cell phone. She got no reception. Sounded like a dead zone. Cutting out like a game show. I bombard her with questions like a caught off guard contestant. She's stuttering like a...
Hey everyone, rounding out the show today, we have our inbox segment with the fabulous John Thomas on the phone. Hey, John.
Hey, Lisa. Thanks. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. Doing well. So, yeah, it's been good. How about you?
Doing great. Loving all the great opportunities to get to answer the inbox stuff. It's been a lot of fun.
Very fun. We love to hear your voice in addition to seeing you in print. We've got a good question for you today. We have someone asking, one reason I stopped watching television was because I noticed that the family dad was always being portrayed as a bumbling idiot, whereas the mom was considered the smart, wise parent who was actually in charge. I heard that this may be part of a feminist agenda, but unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. I also see this on our culture as well, guys being looked at as stupid and immature compared to females. As a single guy who tries to love everyone, how do I respond to a Christian culture that's looking more like the world every day and not showing respect for men?
Such a good question.
Yeah.
And we could go in so many different directions on the answer there. I guess I should start by saying yes. I think all of us can kind of affirm or agree, at least with what you've seen, that observation is pretty accurate. There was a shift at some point in TV land about what a man is. And, you know, we've gone from the Gunsmoke and Bonanza guys, which would probably shows that half of the audience listening doesn't even know what I'm talking about. Good cowboys, I guess I should say, the good guys that were the rescuers and the redeemers and all that kind of thing that they represented. And even, Ward Cleaver was a pretty good dad. There was a shift and in the media. And I don't know if the shift reflects reality or reality has responded to the shift and started acting like it. I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg in this place. But the fact is that both in the culture and as a lot of the media represents it, there is a weak man being represented. So, and I don't know why that is. I don't know if the representation of a strong man is threatening to some people. I think probably it is. I mean, if we wanted to talk about a certain segment of the feminist agenda, I think we would say, yes, they're threatened by the idea of a strong man. I think that, you know, the idea that to be equal means that men are less than women or whatever. I'm not quite sure how to parse all that out, but I do know that, yes, men and women ought to be treated equal, but it doesn't mean that men and women are the same. And I think that's kind of at the heart of the thing, that we're all the same and there are no differences. There are differences, and they're God-given differences. And so this guy's asking, so how do I respond in as a biblical man? And I would just say, I think there's two things. The first thing is you go ahead and feel and have the permission to live differently, to live with humility and unapologetically as a masculine, godly man, and just know that even in the church, yes, there's a bit of a cultural flow that is not a real cheerleader of that. But you can't let that stop you from pursuing real manhood. And then the second thing is that you speak into that place in the culture, your particular, you know, your life, that your generation that you're in, where the attack is. And I think there's an attack here. So you need to learn how to defend biblical manhood in the culture that we're living in right now, because it is at least at that one point among others where we are being attacked. And so I think you read, you learn, you learn how to talk about it, and you live your life in such a way that somebody can see that biblical masculinity is a plus in the culture. It's not a minus. It's not a negative. And in whatever ways that men have been negatives in the culture, and maybe some of that we've earned, some of that reputation, we do what we can to try to reverse that reputation and live in an honoring way. That's about all you can do. I mean, you know, we can turn off the TV and be mad about it, but that really isn't going to impact the culture. I mean, I'm fine turning the TV off. I turn mine off too. But at the same time, we also want to live in such a way that literally changes things.
Yeah, that's good. And obviously to do that, you know, yeah, by not paying attention to entertainment, by choosing to obviously live by the standard that's already been set for us in Scripture, and to not, you know, to turn away from those other influences.
Well, his very conversation that he started here is a great conversation to start somewhere.
Right.
Somebody mentions a TV show and he says, you know what, I quit watching that because of the way it portrayed the dad. And that can spark a conversation that he can then sort of help straighten the record out a little bit. That's what we do. We just do it a little bit at a time. And who knows, maybe someday this guy will grow up and be a screenwriter and he can rewrite the script. I think that would be awesome. I think we need to see more accurate representation of what a real dad ought to look like in the media.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, John Thomas. Those of you out there, if you want to write to us with a question for the future, please write to us at editor@boundless.org. Or maybe you have some thoughts on John's answer or just something from your own experience. Please do weigh in with that as well. And of course, wait around for John Thomas to appear again in the future on the Boundless Show answering more questions. So thanks so much, John, for being part of this.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.